So today we'll be discussing environmentalism, and I think it's a very big word and may have different definitions. But then we've had a whole lot of, campaigns that are going on environmentalism. We've had people's views. Different countries have different opinions on it. And then today we're going to have that discussion, and we have reps. They are not necessarily representing the continent. They are people in the continent who might have experienced the different weather conditions and the changes that are happening in those countries. And we would want them to share their personal opinions on environmentalism. And then who really destroyed it? Because we want it fixed. And some are saying environment really is not actually even destroying anyway. So exactly what are we fixing? So today we want to really understand exactly what environmentalism is and what they seek, what we are trying to achieve with it. And then we want to understand if the environment is really destroying, who really destroyed it? And then how should it be fixed? Who should fix it? And who should pay for the fix? Those are some of the questions that we'll be delving much more into it. So if you have opinions, just let us know. Okay, great. So we'll just move straight onto the show. And then today we're going to discuss environmentalism. And before we do, we would like our guests to introduce themselves. So they will tell us their names, the programs they are offering on campus, and where they come from, and something like that. Yeah, so let's start with my gentleman in front of me.
Good evening, listeners. My name is Dennis Arinabo. I come from Uganda. I'm in my second year doing a PhD in environmental planning and management. And I'm a professional and environmental engineer.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so let's move on to Adi.
Hello, my name is Devina. I'm from Indonesia. I was taking a postgraduate course in University of Edinburgh 2018-2019 in climate change management.
Wonderful. Today we see that we really have experts here.
Hi, my name is Zachary. I'm not a climate change expert. I'm a mechanical engineer at the University of Manchester.
Good. That's good. Yeah, so...
I'm Ada, I'm the welfare and community officer. Again, not a climate change expert, just doing some campaigning stuff around this.
Yeah, an enthusiast or an activist, like if we put it that way, yeah. Something like that. Oh, cool. Even though we have three people that are well-versed in climate change issues, I'm just looking forward to how diverse the discussion is going to be. So, we all understand the issues around the environment and then the various campaigns that people have been making. And so today I want you guys to just explain to our audience exactly what the environmentalism, what your views are on the fight that environmentalism or the activists around environment are trying to push. What do you think they are pushing for? Yeah, so let's start with Dennis.
Thank you very much, Kwame. I think environmentalism is a broad philosophy. It's a social movement. It's an ideology that encompasses itself and identifies itself with the protection of the environment. And its purpose is mainly to create awareness about the importance of the environment to us as humans. And also it aims at changing the way we view the environment and what we can get out of it. And so... its main actions are really targeting protecting environment, and that's all about environmentalism.
Great, yeah. So, does anybody have any different opinion on that?
I would agree with everything with that, but I personally think that environmentalism is almost all encompassing. I think everything we do is kind of environmentalism in one form or another. Activism in the UK, particularly things like Extinction Rebellion and other campaigning groups, are joining a fight that has been going on for centuries across the world and are joining it very late on. And environmentalism has to include migrant justice, has to include solidarity with indigenous people, people from the global south. So it has to be more than just we want the environment to be good. It has to be almost focused on a humanitarian aspect for me personally.
Yeah. Good. So the question, my next question is going to be, I mean, the environment didn't started destroying like today. I mean, so those who make the argument about the fact that the environment is destroying and then there is something that needs to be done about it. I think let's start the debate from when did we realize that the environment was getting destroyed, and were we aware of some of the activities that we used to do then? Were we aware that it had an effect on the environment? Why are we talking about it right now? Yeah.
So, Kwame, I just want to add that I'm majoring in environmental degree, environmental engineering. And if you remember, around 1970, there is this kind of movement. At that time, the vocabulary of climate change on environmentalism did not really in the front, but we in 1970 we think more about like pollution, water pollution, air pollution. So then I think it's starting from that that time we have a Greenpeace and kind of this more about how is it to say more understanding about the environment around us. But the one that I think I want to bring forward is a recent report in 2019. There is a report in the United Nations, the Global Assessment Report in 2019. It said about the state of environment, a recent environment. So they say that around 82% of the biomass, environmental biomass, is already reduced. Compared with the previous condition, so it's really the condition of environment now is really decreasing. So I think people starting to looking around, and then something happening, something different. But then they starting to measure it, to put it in the numbers, and then they found what they found is really really, how is it, surprising in the bad way, that the number is really a lot. That our impact to the environment is enormous.
Okay, so the reason why I wanted us to have a retrospective discussion around this thing is because most of the time we blame the environment destroying on the use of fossil fuels. I think it has been the biggest blame target on the fossil fuels. So, and we all understand that the use of fossil fuels increased during the industrial age, where the West developed lots of machines and other things that increased the consumption of oil. Okay, so my question is, as at that time, were we not having a good understanding of how fossil fuels was going to destroy the environment as at then? But it looks like we waited to make a lot of money out of it, and then now we are talking about it. So was there a knowledge gap, or was it an intentional something? Yeah, so that is the question I want to know. So I don't know if you can assist us in that.
Yeah, let's just consider the Earth planet as a system. So it operates and it has limits, what we call equilibrium. So I think, yes, you're right. The destruction started right at the start of industrialization, which is in the mid-18th century. And most of the people who started the industrialization was Europe, or Western Europe and the US. So the destruction there, we can compare it as it is of today. But the challenge we had then is that the planet population was about 1.2 billion people. But now we are about 7 billion people. So we've had different pressures, not only from the industrial activities and human activities, but also from the population increase. So in the last 100 years, the population has almost quadrupled. So that puts more pressure on the available natural resources. And remember, the Earth planet is like a system, and it cannot expand beyond what it is. It has fixed amount of resources. So the more we produce and the more we consume and take back waste into the environment, that's where the problem is. It's not just that there was a knowledge gap. It's just that problems have caught up with us, and because we are now too much exposed, and the green space is shrinking compared to what it was in the 18th century.
Okay, so I think I'll come back to Adam. Listening to his response, his argument is about population increasing and our demand for certain things also increasing. So not necessarily fossil fuels being a problem, but the fact that its usage has increased and it's affecting the environment, right? So Adam, what would be your response to that?
So I both agree and disagree. I think for a start, the knowledge gap has been a almost forced knowledge gap by certain companies. So I've just been trying to find it. I managed to find it. There's an article from the 14th of August in about 1914 that talks about how the use of carbon at the rate they were going at the time was going to be bad for the environment. I know there's a lecture series from a lecturer from before that as well, roughly 1880, I think, that talks about they kind of know the effects. But I think it's only until if you get into the 1980s, you start to see companies like Shell and ExxonMobil and BP who have scientific research that they know what's going to happen. They know it's going to be a massively massive impact on the environment, on people's health. If they continue to extract fossil fuels. And I think they, and there's a massive concerted effort by them to cover that up, spending millions of pounds a year, and they still continue to, on climate change denial. So I think the knowledge gap's not really, has kind of, it's been there in terms of what the public know. But in terms of the scientists knowing it, in terms of companies knowing it, in terms of governments knowing it, I think we've known for a long time, probably longer than the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It's just that happens to be when people actually started thinking about it. I mean, it's potentially topical because ExxonMobil is currently in court in the US for lying about this stuff this week. But I also think, as you were saying, that it does start to become a problem with the Industrial Revolution. We start to use more, we start to consume more, whether that be fossil fuels, whether that be metal without precious materials. I think that's one of the biggest factors is overconsumption. And I think, I guess something we'll come on to in a minute is how do we fix the problem? And I think that is much more about reduction than trying to find a technological solution. So I would say that while I agree with you, and I think population has grown, I think it's much more the overconsumption of certain countries, for example, the UK, Europe, the US, historic overconsumption that has caused like the massive problem that we're currently having. But yeah, like I do fully agree that population growth can't continue in the way it has in Western countries.
Zaki, you can maybe you are not in the technical realm as myself. I'm also not in the technical realm. But my question is when we get to the messages that we see activists send across, I don't think they talk about reduction. They talk about divestment, which means that they are trying to come up with a message that fossil fuels is the problem and then we need to divest from it. Not necessarily that maybe there has been population increase and all that. But the reason why I want Zach to come in is, you know, you're a mechanical...
Yes,
you're a mechanical student, so you have more knowledge on that. My point is, when I was doing my research, countries rather in Asia and Africa hold most of these crude oil reserves, which happens to have most of these fossil fuels.
Yes.
Okay. And so if you hear some of these activists talk about divestment, what do you think the implication would be if corporations actually heed to their claims?
What do I think that would happen to the nations? In the case of some places, it might be better, especially for like places like the Middle East that's been so much conflict surrounded the whole thing with oil and things like that, like whole like wars waged over like this natural resource. So I think it'd probably be better for countries like Africa and the Middle East. Like if you think about it, look at the places that are known to have oil reserves, and look at the places that are known to have terrorism,
mm-hmm.
why does it seem to be that there's a correlation between the two? You know what I mean? There's Islam in India, there's Islam in Indonesia. Why is it that it so happens to be in these places? And you'd hear the West talking about, oh, we don't conspire with terrorists and things like that. But they have in the past when it comes to, like, taking out people who are not for them, like people like Gaddafi, people like, I think the king of Iran back in, like, the 70s or whatever, he was very secular. And I believe the CIA brought all of, like, the very radical Islamic groups together and funded them to overthrow this king back in the day. So really and thoroughly, I think the divestment from natural resources will be good for these countries in the end. And I also think, too, that these countries need to, like, start focusing on where do we go next. For example, in Trinidad and Tobago, my neighbor, in terms of country, they had such an amazing oil boom. And if you look at, like, the country now, like, what's happening, there are, like, different oil refineries shutting down and all sorts of different things happening there. Why didn't they take that money and invest in different things, invest in, like, new technology, invest in service industries and things like that? Why are they just focused on oil? You understand what mm-hmm. I mean? So I think the divestment from oil wouldn't necessarily have an impact on the countries in, like, Asia or Africa. I think what needs to happen is that there needs to be responsible leadership, and the leaders need to know that, okay, the world is moving away from these harmful fossil fuels and things like that. So, like, where do we reinvest into? That's would be my take on it.
Yeah, but then you see, when you take a country like, let's say, Nigeria, like, more than 80% of their export revenue comes from crude oil. Okay, so, and then crude oil is a natural resource. They don't have to manufacture it. It's a natural resource. Compare it to, let's say, wind energy, where they need to install some other equipment in order to do this, which requires capital and all those kind of things. So right now we have companies that have already invested in the capital infrastructure, in the extraction of crude oil and everything. So if you say that they should divest, and they might not, it would solve some of the fights that usually happen around the oil region. Do you think just stopping the fights is okay? Would that be the only positive impact divestment would have?
No, I think, yes, it would. My point is this, that, like, I don't think your economy should be oil-based, because oil is a finite resource at the end of the day. So I don't think structuring your economy around this thing is the best way. Look at Venezuela, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Venezuela has the largest known oil reserves in the world.
Yeah.
Yet still, look at the hyperinflation that's happening in Venezuela. I think Hugo Chavez was a good leader, but I think his one downfall was that he should have started to think, okay, the future is moving green. Where do I take these profits from this crude oil and reinvest it into something that could benefit my country, like manufacturing new products or sustainable manufacturing, new types of agriculture, different things like that. So I don't...
Like, let's what Dubai did, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, like what Dubai did. But, yeah, you want to add something?
Yeah, just an additional. I agree with Zachary about divesting from the fossil fuel, but we must understand also that according to the World Development Indicator 2016, that economic development really linked with the high carbon growth. So... So the economic development, so the development of this the countries, especially the poor countries, is really given its dependence on extensive use of fossil fuels. So, for example, like Indonesia or Malaysia, all the developing countries. So divesting it from the fossil fuel economy is really hard work. So it needs a lot of, it's the basic. Still now I think we starting to understand the impact. Try to do to the more correct way, but now we are doing that. So I agree about some of the what Adam say about the there is a lot of population in this developing country that they still need basic needs. They still need electricity, place to stay. So we need to fulfill their basic needs too, but try to decoupling it, try to attach it from the fossil fuel development is what is our challenge now.
Yeah, exactly. And then the point I want to add maybe before you add your point is that you're talking about, let's say, countries not, you know, modeling their economics around just trade around oil, like let's say Nigeria. But the question I have is that if they don't, they have to go into the other forms of trade, let's say industry and all that. But you shouldn't also forget about the competition that exists in the global trade at the moment, where the reason why most African countries or most Asian countries are relying on this is because of the strength they have, having the crude as the natural resource. But moving into other spaces, they do not have the strength to compete. So let's look at competition as one of the, you can talk to us about how countries can deal with competition.
When they divest
from crude oil into other spaces for revenue.
What do you mean when you say competition? Competition and what?
Exactly. So if people divest from raising revenue from the exportation of, let's say, crude oil, it means they have to go into the trade of some other things, right?
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's my point, that let's say if they are to go back into developing softwares as, exporting that one as a service, what we are looking at, the competition in the global global trade,
right?
Around softwares, that how can let's say Ghana developing a software competing with Microsoft in the US, so I'm talking about if they move from that the space that they have strength, which is a natural resource, into the other spaces that we think are okay right now, like doesn't really affect the environment. My point is, how would they be able to compete, to be able to make much more money to provide the basic needs that their people need?
Right. Okay.
So my next question goes to Adam. My question to you is, when you take fossil fuels, like we are saying, let's look at the cost. And then comparing the cost to renewable energy, like things that are produced out of wind energy, solar energy. We know the cost of even setting up a solar energy and all that. Do you think environmentalism, from that point, if you are supposed to talk about divestment, would rather benefit the poor as compared to the rich or the capitalist that we think is benefiting from fossil fuels?
So this is why when I started talking about environmentalism and what my definition of it is because it's not just about the environment. And when I think about divestment and when I talk about divestment, it is a small part of a much bigger and much more intricate idea of environmentalism. And divestment has to then be followed by reinvestment in ethical or renewable technologies for that to make any real difference. But as you were saying, if you were to just divest and were to push green technologies as they are now, or at least as they are seen now by governments, it would impact the poorest in society really hard, like much worse than anyone else. And the people who are rich would continue to get richer and the people who are poor would continue to get poorer. But that's why you don't see... The idea of just transitioning straight away is a completely flawed one, because so many people would be absolutely decimated by that. And there has to be a just transition for everyone from fossil fuels to a much more renewables-based infrastructure. As part of that, we have to do things like reduce energy need or energy want by a lot, by about 60%, and then keep increasing the the amount of renewables we make. So if you think about, for example, 70% of all carbon emissions being produced by 100 companies across the world. If you got those 100 companies, which are big fossil fuel companies, to all invest their money in renewable energy, we'd be in a much better position than we are now. Renewable energy isn't that much more expensive than fossil fuels. And the only reason it is more expensive is because fossil fuels are subsidized by governments. So, for example, the UK government subsidizes fossil fuel companies by £10.5 billion every year. They invest only about 2.3 into renewables. That's more than any other EU country, and it's the only G7 country that's investing more this year than it did last year. And so how we think about renewables and how we think about fossil fuels has to change. It has to be a massive culture shift for Western kind of global North countries. In that it can't just be we're transitioning to renewables and we can keep going exactly how we are, because that will inevitably impact the poorest of society the worst. What we need to think about is, okay, we need to reduce emissions, we need to reduce our energy demand, and then find a way for a just transition so that we can keep using fossil fuels as much as we need to, but to get everyone to a point of like, oh, we can use renewables, but on a localized scale. So as was said before, the people who don't have access to energy tend to be from countries where a lot of energy extraction happens. And that's because the energy, the oil that's being extracted isn't going to those countries. It's being shipped somewhere else to be refined and then is going to Western countries to burn for whatever a lot of the time. And so I think we need to find either a proper globalized solution to energy, in that we stop thinking about it as nation states and we each actually help each other in a proper systematic way. Or we start thinking locally, which may be more applicable short term, in that instead of extracting oil from this country, shipping it to here to refine it and shipping it back here to use it, you use local renewable energy so that each community, each city, each town, each province, county, whatever, is producing its own energy for its use, so that nobody is then reliant on trade, on commerce, because inevitably oil prices are going to either skyrocket or drop, which is going to cause it to not be able to be used by, again, the poorest in society. And so we need to find a way of dealing with that and getting onto renewables before that happens, because that's essentially inevitable at this point.
But you've made a very good point. But the argument, the counter argument to that is, you know, we have countries that have resources, okay, and then we have some other countries that do not have that sort of resource. So don't you think it's actually a strategy to make the West more independent? It's like a strategy to make sure the West is able to come up with technologies that they have more control over, because like you're saying, we come up with renewable energies that they can find locally so that it wouldn't depend on commerce, right? Because most of the fossil fuels that is being imported get refined here, capitalists here make a lot of money out of it, and then the poor person back in Ghana or Nigeria do not make a lot from it. But the point is that even if they are making £2 out of it, that is what the government is using to sustain certain things in there. So if we get demand from Europe and let's say America being cut off, how in the interim, let's even talk about in the interim, how would we expect those countries in there to survive?
I think we must realize that environmental problems are transboundary. You cannot contain an environmental problem for a particular country. If one country is causing the problem, then the entire globe will be affected. And so we have the capacity to all move simultaneously as 201 countries across the globe and make sure we have a meaningful impact. But at the same time also, we need to realize that the safe operating space for us as humans is now getting encroached on by environmental problems that are affecting us already. And so the Western world making sure that there is a drop in oil demands and for them to transfer from that to clean renewable energy, it's not going to help anybody, because at the end of the day, if the problem is happening in Africa, it's not only contained in Africa. It will happen across the Indian and Pacific Ocean. Before you know it, it's reaching you here in Europe. So I think as we think about the green technology here in developed countries, we must also put up strategies to make sure that we help countries in low-income and middle-income countries to move along with us, because we must move together, or if one part is affected, then every one of us will be affected.
Exactly, yeah. So that's a very fair point. I mean, Adam also made a very fair point. But my next question, we move on to how should it be fixed? Okay, so there have been a lot of suggestions. So we've been talking about some moving on to renewable energy, some also talking about we should plant a lot of trees. The question I was asking was that some people have made an argument that it is humans that actually invaded the space of animals. So it means we had a lot of trees, and other things that we decided to cut them. But then when you go more into the Western world, you hardly find trees in the cities. The reason why I'm talking about the Western world is because that is where the pressures for divestment is coming from. So the question is, we know trees inhale carbon, right? They inhale carbon dioxide, and then humans rather exhale it. So is it that we do not have enough trees to absorb the carbon dioxide that we are talking about, the carbon that is being emitted? And then if that is so, why do we want to divest rather than saying that, okay, let's just get everybody to plant trees as a way of fixing it?
I just want to add something, Kwame. I think the environmental itself, you must not see a tree as a tree. In order to really give a greater benefit, a tree need also the environment. So for example, you must see like a tropical forest in Indonesia or in Amazon, for example, they kind of ecosystem. So they support many kind of lives, and they give more benefit if they are intact in not only in 1 kilometer, 1 square kilometer, not only one single tree, but if they are in the vast big forest, you cannot. It's not about planting one tree, and it's not about the amount, the number of the trees, but the ecosystem itself to be able to have a greater benefit for and to able to sustain our future. You need more ecosystem, not only one tree. So it's just an idea.
Yeah. But I mean, we've been talking about the fact that, like, yeah, if everybody used to grow trees, then we will have that ecosystem of trees. So that's what I was talking about. But my point is, another question that somebody just posted to us was that the youth of today, we've been demanding a lot from our governments, and then demanding a lot as human beings from our government. But then at another point, we are the same person demanding for some of these divestments. So the question is, exactly what do we want our governments to do? Because when it comes to the UK, we students are campaigning for free education, but which has to do with money. We are campaigning that government should divest and invest more in renewable energies, which has to do with money. And then if we come to say the government should be the one providing energy, everything that, I mean, the capitalist will come in. So, and at the same time, we feel like it is a capitalist that is making money out of fossil fuels and that we want to break it. So my point is, are we making a recommendation that it should be the government owning the production of renewable energy, just so the capitalist doesn't find their way in there like they did in fossil fuels to make a lot of money? Or we, the youth, should find a way of reducing some of our demands and just focus on one?
Well, first, I think there are two ways we can fix this. One is to change the ways we produce, and the second one is the way we consume. when you look at the per capita consumption of an average person every day, each person of out of the 7 billion people, we produce about 1.5 kilograms of waste. So my thinking would be, if we as consumers, we can maybe check our behaviors and we cut down on how much we take in, how much we consume, then that would reduce the amount of total waste that is going into the environment. And also the way we produce, we must move into technological kind of advancement to leave the era of fossil fuels and being dependent on fossil fuels, and try to invest in maybe electrification and maybe wind energy. And that comes also with the fact that we've seen over the past couple of decades, the Western Europe and the Americas investing in Africa for carbon sequestration, whereby they encourage Africans to grow more trees so that the carbon produced from the Western developed world can be absorbed in the African basin. So there are different policies here and there trying to fix the problem, but at the same time, we must make sure there's monitoring and making sure that the money sent for carbon trade, for example, is doing what it's supposed to do in Africa.
Yeah, if I can cut you in there, I think you made a very valid point. You made a very good point, not a valid one, actually, in relation to, trees being grown in Africa to be absorbing the carbon that is being produced. So you see, like, is that actually even right, that one place should be the ones with the trees, and then one can have the liberty to produce what they want, you know, make money, and then just give you money to plant trees to absorb the carbon that we produce. Like, is it right?
We must struggle and find the right balance between the two, because at the end of the day, like I said, environmental challenges are transboundary. So if they can't do it here, then they must make sure we have somewhere else where it's being done. If we can't plant more trees here because of the population and because of the urban city agglomerations, then we can think of other places that are vast and vacant and available for growing trees. And so in that case, because there's no technology, you can see how the forest cover, for example, is decreasing on the Amazon in African regions, sub-Saharan Africa. And even in Europe, you can say, okay, here it has decreased by 20%. Maybe you can invest more money and make sure that, you know, yeah, there's at the end of the day, we must find a right balance.
So, Zach, I want to ask you this. Let's say if we decide to fix by divesting, you know, like you are into mechanical engineering. So let's say, do you think we should ground, close down all factories, ground or aeroplanes, like stop cars from moving and focus on just wind energy, so wind energy, solar energy, and those things, are they possible, as in those sources of energy, are they possible in powering our factories, powering our cars and all those things at the moment?
At the moment, it's a yes and a no. No, in the sense that, like, obviously, like, countries need to have the infrastructure in to be able to facilitate these different things. I don't think, like, you see the thing with, like, renewable technology, there isn't, like, one specific renewable technology that will necessarily win or lose. It's going to come from a combination of different solutions, whether it's biomass, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, and even nuclear. Nuclear is a very viable option, obviously, because of the legacy that nuclear has had. The public don't necessarily want nuclear, but I think in the future nuclear has to play a role, because with the same thing with solar also takes up a lot of land. Wind also takes up a lot of land. So are we going to cut down more trees so that we can have the same solar?
Let me even cut you in there and ask a follow-up question with Adam. So Adam, you realize that he talked about nuclear, and we understand that nuclear is supposed to be the cheapest and the cleanest.
Yes.
Okay. But then, he said?
Stable.
And even more stable. Yeah. Good. So 3-3-5 is the cleanest, the cheapest, and more stable. But do you know that nuclear energy is actually being used in the West? You know, and then it's supposed to be the cheapest, that easily should be used in the Africa, South East, Asian countries that may not have, like, that have their disposable income is low, but have, you know, crude oil as their only source of, if I put it that way, their only source of cheap access to energy. And so if you really want to divest, why is it becoming a problem for the West to make it easy? Because it's a certification. Certifications are also done here in the West. Why is it so difficult for them to just make it easy for everybody to use, everybody down there to be able to use nuclear energy? However, they that have higher disposable income are rather using nuclear energy and still calling for divestment. You know, like, why do you think that is the case? And don't you sense some sort of hypocrisy in there?
Yeah, I think there are two points that I want to make on this. First, that divestment is not a solution, or at least not a solution on its own. It is simply a statement to oil, gas, etc. companies that we're not going to tolerate them being as bad as they have been for the last however many years they've existed for. And so divestment is not a solution, nor would I suggest it to be one. The second point, though, is that, yeah, I fully agree. Nuclear energy in its current form, if you're at least thinking long-term anyway, is potentially the most viable energy source that we have the ability to use. And I fully agree that it's essentially been hoarded by kind of Western governments in a way that I think the best way to think about it is that we've stopped thinking, because of the money-based system that we have,
mm-hmm.
we've stopped thinking about the economy as what it should be. And economics is described as your sharing of resources and not your sharing of money. But our society is now so transfixed on this idea of growth and GDP that we keep everything for ourselves so that we can grow and we can develop. And we never really allow that technology to be shared, because we live in a system which is still stuck in colonialist, racist agenda that governments, corporations still prescribe to because it suits them. Like you're saying, it makes them money. It makes BP, Shell, Exxon, but also governments. So the US, British governments all make money out of having this technology, which they can use because it gives them cheaper energy.
Yeah.
And it is something that should be shared equally. Obviously, the poorer you are, the more easy it should be for you to access that cleaner energy so that you don't have to spend hundreds, thousands, millions of pounds a year trying to get energy from really expensive sources. But I think expensive comes into two parts, is whether you're thinking about it in terms of money or whether you're thinking about it in terms of the environment.
Yeah.
Or in fact, whether you're thinking about it in terms of everything else as well as money.
So you made a valid point about the fact that now the economy is not really around sharing of resources, but it seemed to be around sharing of money. I usually call it countries are sort of competing. Countries are becoming like businesses that are competing. So like you just said, in that space where we are not actually having an ideal situation in the economy, then what do you think should be the solution? Should it still be divestment? Or should it still be, so going into renewable energies, knowing that people will still approach it from the capitalist point of view in terms of profit making and neglecting the poor people that may be affected with the divestment? Yes.
I think it's, then you say earlier also, Kwame, about that there is this kind of money and there is a lot of needs for people. So I think it's for we need to do it now. I think the money is maybe enough, but you need to give the push to the policymaker to make the correct decision. For example, like this, by educating people about the environment, about the climate change, by communicating the impact, by saying that this is what happened with the environment now, this is what happened with the climate emergency now, this is our state now. And if we continue to do like this, we will we will have a bad condition. By having a lot of people understand about this in the same view with us, we can give a good push to our government, to our policymaker to choose the correct decision. For example, to taking out the subsidy for fossil fuel, the government needs a lot of support to do that, to put out the subsidy from fossil fuel, to put it in the renewable, or to put it in the other good things. They need a lot of support because this is a difficult decision. So I think also relating with the Adam said, it needs a transition. So in this time of transition, we need to educate more people to make them understand and to communicate in the good way. So if many people understand about this, we can create the not only local or national collaboration, but we hope a global collaboration.
I think the point, I think any of you can just answer to that. So yeah, certainly we need to educate people about everything. But the point is, if you are educating them on the need to take subsidies from fossil fuel and maybe invest it in renewable energy, we're talking about politicians who need votes, okay? And we're talking about a poor person who also want a politician to contribute, you know, to make things affordable for them. So those are the two dynamics that we are looking at here at the moment. So if we allow the politician to do this, you know, and then certainly the poor person is going to vote against him because then his access to energy is going to be expensive. So that's why initially I was talking about the fact that we demand so much as people, you know, and then we seem to neglect the effect of some of the demands that we make. So
this is why, personally, I think we just get rid of politicians. So, easier said than done. But the current system of democracy, and I'm quote-unquote democracy because it's, yeah, democracy whether you want it or not, is just not working. It's not viable. People are getting completely screwed over by MPs, governments, all of the time. Even if you don't look at the environment, there's still so many massive issues that we need to deal with at the same time that are all linked into the same problem. And I think there is a solution to that, and it's a complete switch of how you do governance and democracy. So I don't know how many of you know about this, but the whole democratic confederalism or democratic autonomy that's been used in Rojava and part of Kurdistan at the moment. So basically, Kurdistan in the Syrian part, in a place called Rojava, has the system of democratic autonomy. And the idea is that you have like local councils for each village, which and then each town and then each city and then for the region and then district, mm-hmm. That deal with different issues. So you have the peace one, you have the agriculture one, the defense one.
Yeah.
And they are essentially people there that are elected by those people who know them in the communities.
Yeah.
They go to those meetings. And then when that meeting has dealt with that issue, they disband. So they're not then re-elected every time. They're not looking for re-election. They are working for the community that they live in.
Yeah.
And each of those then reports higher and higher up, and you get to a point where you have like a democratic, autonomous system that works for as many people as possible within that system. And it's a system that's based on both ecological and also like very heavily feminist principles. And it's potentially a way out of the ecological humanitarian crisis that we're facing. It's obviously under massive threat at the moment because of Turkey. But it's a potential way of governing that means that you avoid politicians being elected, so they're not acting in the short term. You avoid much more corruption because you don't have people who can be paid off by corporations continuing to rerun.
Yeah. And
and they're working for the people.
I can really believe, you know, this will happen in the next 1,000 years.
But this is the thing. It happened over like almost within a year and a half.
Exactly. Rojava, but so. Then, yeah, that has been the situation. But it's like we are running short of time. So everybody has 1 minute. And then I want you to tell us exactly the fight environmentalism should focus on at the moment. what fight should it focus on at the moment that wouldn't, at the end of the day, run poor people being the worst people or being the worst affected by environmentalism? Yeah, how should it be done?
I would say, being a research student, I would encourage policy integration, because we live in a human dominated world at the moment, at 7 billion people. And so we must realize we've come into a crisis, and most times crises create opportunities for us to move forward. And so there's no way we can separate environment from transport, from tourism, from agriculture, from politics, because everything, the system works in an interconnected way. So if we can integrate environmental policies into, for example, agriculture, have sustainable tourism, have these issues of banning the Amazon out of tourist behaviors, you know, throwing a piece of cigarette that has fire on it and then burns the entire forest. So if we integrate the environmental policies into every other sector, then hopefully we'll make our way.
Great. So what would be your advice as to what environmentalism should focus on to make sure poor people don't become the worst affected?
I think coming from an engineering perspective, I think with like government policy, there should be a movement towards investing in sustainable solutions. So solutions that require less energy, less water, like for agriculture or like just different things in general. So I think a focus on investing in like new technologies and things like that to provide sustainable solutions.
Great. Yeah. Adam, any advice?
I think environmentalism has to be a movement of movements. You can't have an environmentalist movement, like Dennis was saying, that isn't focusing on almost every issue. But I think if you're talking about activists in general, so if you're talking about XR, if you're talking about kind of activism in the UK, it has to start focusing on mobilizing and using its privilege to push for anti-racist, anti-patriarchal, anti-capitalist movement, because otherwise we are just going to end up with, yes, we may deal with the climate crisis, which we probably won't, but yes, you may deal with that one issue, but every issue within that system is still going to remain if we don't deal with that, and we're just going to end up in another crisis and another one and another one. And so the environmental movement has to deal with so much more than just the environment. But in doing that, it has to make sure that it's doing that by centering the voices of the people most affected, indigenous people, people of color, people in the global south, migrants, etc. So,
and I just totally agree with you. And yeah, 20 seconds.
Educating for the young and raising awareness for the rest, because we must agree with Adam, we must create awareness that we are in the same planet, in the one ship, that even the most privileged of all will also get the effect. So everyone in the same ship is we will all there. So just raise the awareness and education.
So thank you very much for all. I think we've had a very interesting discussion. Yeah, thank you all for coming. And then, yeah, this is where we draw the curtain on Ginseng on Radio. And then meet us next.